Welcome to The Point. I'm Catherine Iden, filling in for Mindy Todd. Opioid addiction is a national public health emergency. 2016 data from the Centers for Disease Control found the number of overdose deaths involving opioids was five times higher than in 1999, with approximately 115 people dying each day from opioid overdoses. The good news is that recent statistics from the state of Massachusetts show the number of opioid-related overdose deaths from prescription drugs decreased slightly last year. But the concerning news is that prescription opioids are no longer driving the addiction epidemic. According to a report from the CDC last year, heroin, synthetic opioids such as fentanyl, and increasingly cocaine, methamphetamines are also contributors. Today, we're going to discuss some of the reasons addiction to opioids spiked after 1999, despite there not being an overall change in the amount of pain people were reporting. We'll also look at changes in prescribing protocols for opioids, alternative treatments for pain management, and some next steps for addressing this issue. Joining us this morning in studio is Dr. Robert Caldas, Senior Vice President and Chief Medical Officer of South Coast Health. Welcome. Thank you for being here.
Good morning. Welcome.
And joining us on the phone is Dr. Andrew Kolodny. He is the co-director of opioid policy research at the Heller School for Social Policy and Management at Brandeis University. Dr. Kolodny, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's first, before we kind of talk about where we're at today, let's add some context and talk about how opioids were first marketed to physicians and how this kind of epidemic came to be. Dr. Caldas, you want to start us off?
Sure. Opioids have always been existent. Morphine has, been age-old and used in medicine correctly for many years. In the late 90s, there was a push by one of the pharmaceutical companies, or Purdue Pharmaceuticals, for their new product, OxyContin, which they had touted as being non-addictive. And that marketing really led a lot of people to want to use that product, thinking that they were avoiding the dangers of addiction.
Mm.
It was later found out that that was not true,
right.
And the damage had already been done. Many people had actually already been started on OxyContin, and its use had already been kind of entwined in medical therapy. Purdue Pharmaceuticals then ended up facing a pretty severe penalty,
mm-hmm.
And still they're on probation because of their misguided marketing.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Kolodny, I want to say, feel free to join in on this conversation. I know you can't, because you're on the phone there. I don't want you to feel like you're getting left out. We started out there, we thought that, this kind of was a magic pill in a way we could reduce pain and not have any side effects, but we learned otherwise. But why did we see prescriptions? We all have these stories of, the wisdom teeth extraction where you walk out of there and you've got enough for 30 days when your pain from a type of surgery like that really doesn't last that long. Do we know why that kind of prescribing started to happen? Dr. Kolodny, do you want to join in here?
Sure. And,
We have a little bit of a little bit broken up there, Dr. Kolodny.
Let me see if I can fix that. Hold on one sec.
That sounds a lot better.
Is this working any better?
That's working better, yes.
Okay. So certainly what was said about OxyContin is true, and the ways in which Purdue Pharma marketed OxyContin absolutely contributed to our epidemic. The behaviors that they engaged in, the activities that they engaged in, though, that I think were more damaging, and it wasn't just Purdue Pharma, it was ultimately other opioid manufacturers. What they did was to change the way the medical community thought about opioids as a class of drug. They got into trouble in 2007 for some of the specific misinformation mm-hmm. and lies they told about their OxyContin formulation. But what they really did that was far more damaging was to convince the medical community that opioids rarely lead to addiction, the class of drug.
Mm-hmm.
And the medical community begins hearing not just from sales reps working for Purdue, but we begin hearing from pain specialists eminent in the field of pain medicine. We're hearing from our hospitals, our professional societies, our state medical boards, from every direction. We were hearing that patients are suffering because we've been too stingy with opioids, and that true addiction very rarely develops in a patient who has legitimate pain, and that we should be much more liberal in our prescribing. And as we responded to this brilliant, multifaceted marketing campaign, and the prescribing started to go up, it led to the severe epidemic of opioid addiction and overdose deaths that we're dealing with today. In terms of dentists or other clinicians who treat acute pain, in terms of why they might overprescribe, you know, I think that if a dentist understood that hydrocodone, the ingredient in Vicodin, or oxycodone, the ingredient in Percocet and OxyContin, if the dentist understood that that molecule is almost identical to the heroin molecule, not simply in its structure, but in its effects, an experienced heroin user really can't tell the difference between hydrocodone or oxycodone or heroin. If they understood that these were essentially heroin pills, I doubt that they'd be giving a teenager 20 pills when the teenager might not have needed any. In many cases, you can treat dental pain without opioids.
Right. How long do we know how long it does take, let's say, on average, to develop a dependence or an addiction to an opiate?
If you're taking an opioid every day, in as little as 5 days, you become physiologically dependent, meaning you're going to feel sick when you try and stop it. And, of course, the longer you're on it, and the higher the dose, the greater the degree of physiological dependence that sets in. And while physiological dependence on the drug is not exactly the same thing as addiction, it does explain why opioids are so highly addictive, because you feel so sick and you can feel a worsening of pain when you try and stop.
Right, right. Well, and as we mentioned, Purdue Pharma, one of, you know, several major manufacturers, kind of getting itself in trouble there, kind of spearheading some of the marketing. And it just announced recently it's not going to market the drug any longer to doctors. Dr. Caldas, do you think that's going to help, or is it too late? I mean, OxyContin, really, it's a household name.
It is a household name, and I think it may be a little bit too late. It's in such widespread use. Fortunately, the interventions that are being put into place for the opioid crisis appear to be affecting our prescribing of opiates. So I think it will correct over time. But, you know, to stop now marketing to physicians is really a little too little too late.
Too little too late, yeah. 866-999-4626. You can email us, thepoint at capeandislands.org. We want to hear from you. Have you been offered an alternative pain relief option recently by your doctor? And did you elect to try them? Give us a call or send us an email. Let us know your story. 866-999-4626 or thepoint at capeandislands.org. So as I said kind of in the introduction here, we just got some statistics from the Commonwealth of Massachusetts saying that there was a slight decrease both in prescriptions for opioids last year and also in opioid-related deaths, just a little bit of a decrease, which is notable because for many years we've seen an increase in those, in those numbers. So it sounds like there's some changes happening. How would you say Massachusetts is doing in addressing opioid prescribing? Dr. Kaladny, let's say from a policy standpoint.
Well, based on the data that we saw released yesterday from the Massachusetts Health Department, it looks like Massachusetts is doing pretty good. Mm-hmm. The prescribing is trending in the right direction. There is still massive overprescribing. We're still far too often prescribing opioids when we don't need to prescribe opioids, and we're prescribing more opioids than we have to when an opioid might be necessary. So we've got a long way to go, but it is moving in the right direction. And I think something to keep in mind is that more cautious prescribing is really important if we want this epidemic to ultimately come to an end. The vast majority of people who've become opioid addicted since 1996, their opioid addiction began with prescription opioids. Younger people who become opioid addicted, people in their 20s, 30s, early 40s, that's the group that winds up on the black market after they become addicted. Mm. These young folks can get addicted from doctors' prescriptions, but once they are addicted and they need to maintain a large supply, they have a hard time doing that, visiting doctors, because doctors don't like to give healthy-looking young people lots of pills every month for chronic pain. So that's the group that's wound up in the black market. That's the group where we're seeing a soaring, we've been seeing a soaring increase in deaths because of fentanyl and the heroin supply. The more cautious prescribing, though, is necessary for preventing more people from becoming opioid addicted. And in the older people who've been dying of prescription opioid overdoses, more cautious prescribing may be reducing deaths in that population.
And in South Coast, for South Coast Health, in your hospitals, Dr. Caldas, we have a statewide policy now where prescriptions are limited to a week. Is that right? But you've kind of gone farther with that. Talk about that.
We've adopted the state and governor recommendations for opioid prescribing. So new patients on an opioid will get no more than 7 days for a new script, and also for minors. Those people who are engaged in chronic opioid therapy through a pain clinic requires a connection with that pain clinic to coordinate their care when they leave. Additionally, our emergency rooms have started to use IV Tylenol as well as the EMS in our areas as an adjunct for pain control. They've also worked with our pain management specialists to learn alternative therapies and can offer for certain conditions trigger point injections and other alternatives to really try to decrease the use of opiates. We've developed order sets in the emergency room for a lot of the common pain syndromes that people will present with, looking at using non-opioid medications in combination to try to reduce the opiate usage. Our recent statistics that we have show that we have at least a 15 to 25% decrease in the opiate prescribing within the emergency room and also at the time of discharge.
866-999-4626, the point at capeandislands.org. We'd love to hear from you. You mentioned that you've started using some alternatives, which I'd love to talk about a little later, but it kind of made me think, you know, what happened, you know, we talked about marketing being one reason why opioids started to flood the system, but what kind of role did the state play early on, or did health insurance companies play in maybe pushing this or encouraging more opioid use? I mean, you mentioned that IV ibuprofen or IV Tylenol on the ambulance is fairly new. There wasn't that option before. It was kind of 0 to 60, right? You either got the ice compress or you got the big guns, the opioids. Right. Why was there no middle ground for so long?
I think we, through regulatory agencies and the use of the opiates, got into this situation where we expected that we would be able to reduce and relieve pain. And I think the general public also had that expectation that they would be able to come in, have a major procedure, and have no discomfort. The Joint Commission, which accredits hospitals, had actually made pain their fifth vital sign. And so they were very keyed into the fact that we, you know, as Dr. Kolodny said, had been too stingy and really weren't addressing people's pain. And so they felt it important to make sure that, you know, people's pain were being addressed. That really put a focus on pain relief and really took us away from where we were using those medicines in adjunct as people were recovering. But we all had an expectation that pain was part of the recovery process and that we would help to keep people comfortable. But it was never the expectation that we would take it away completely. And so that emphasis was started by the Joint Commission. They've now changed their posture and now have a lot of new standards looking at reducing opioid usage. But it was key in really focusing in on quality metrics within the hospital for pain relief. Additionally, payers picked up as quality metrics metrics that had to do with pain relief, and one in particular was, you know, the percentage of patients who had pain relief with long bone fractures in the emergency room. So those types of pressures really made it easier for people to revert or use opioids.
Dr. Kolodny, are you seeing changes with health insurance companies in the way in which they look at prescriptions and they look at pain management overall?
Yes, I think that health insurance companies like other stakeholders, are becoming much more engaged in addressing the opioid crisis. And I think there's a recognition among payers, just as there is now among state legislatures and governors and AGs and CDC, that overprescribing of opioids is really what's been fueling the epidemic for for many years. I think the opioid crisis was misunderstood as a drug abuse problem. The idea being that this isn't about doctors writing too many prescriptions. It's about kids getting into grandma's medicine chest. And how do we stop kids from abusing these drugs? When, you know, nobody at the time was asking, you know, why does every grandma now have opioids in her medicine chest? Fortunately, we do have a recognition that it's been overprescribing that's been fueling this problem all along. And health insurance companies are beginning to step up to the plate. They have a very important role because not only are they paying for the visits where an opioid might be prescribed and paying for the prescription, the opioid prescription itself, but they also are responsible for paying for treatment for opioid addiction.
Right.
So there's really an important role they can play in helping prevent overuse of opioids, which lead to addiction, as well as improving access to addiction treatment.
Right, right. They're really in this game, really from start to finish. We are going to take a quick break, but stay with us, and we're going to talk more about this issue and take some of your questions when we come back. Thank you for joining us for The Point. You're listening to The Point. I'm Catherine Ident, in for Mindy Todd. My guests are Dr. Robert Caldas, Senior Vice President and Chief Medical Officer of South Coast Health. And on the phone with us is Dr. Andrew Kolodny, co-director of opioid policy research at Brandeis University. And we're talking about opioid prescriptions and the opioid crisis. We're also taking your questions and comments. Give us a call, 866-999-4626, or email us at thepoint@thecapeandislands.org. So, Dr. Kolodny, you helped shape some guidelines issued by the CDC a few years ago for doctors when it comes to prescribing opioids. Can you talk about those a little bit?
Yeah, actually, I really didn't help shape those guidelines. My organization, PROP, was one of many stakeholder groups that was sent a draft of the guidelines and gave CDC feedback on them. Mm-hmm. It's funny that you ask, because there are some conspiracy theories on social media, some of which have really been fostered by pain organizations funded by industry to discredit the guidelines or to make them seem controversial. And woven into those conspiracy theories is this idea that my organization had an undue influence on the development of the guidelines. We really didn't. Mm-hmm. And although we thought the guidelines were necessary and agreed with the recommendations, we also thought, to some extent, that they were a bit weak. Since the CDC guideline came out, there's now a guideline from the Veteran Affairs Administration and from the Department of Defense, a new guideline, which we like a lot better. And unlike the CDC guideline, which said that for chronic non-cancer pain, opioids are not preferred, the VA guideline went further. They really said we don't initiate long-term opioids, and we like that better. For many people with chronic pain, the most common being low back pain with a normal spine, opioids are really not safe or even effective. And so I think, you know, it's more important to send the message to the medical community, don't get more people stuck on a treatment that's unlikely to help them. I will say that there are millions of patients who've been put on chronic opioids, many of whom may never be able to come off. And for those who are able to come off, it's going to require a lot of help and support. And something we have to be careful about is that as the medical community gets the idea that we shouldn't have been doing this, we don't want primary care docs to start forcing their patients off very quickly. It could drive some patients to the street. And certainly if a patient is abruptly taken off of opioids, the withdrawal that they experience can be excruciating and could even potentially drive people to suicide. So what we have to be really careful as we try and get out of this mess.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Caldas, you know, there's a couple points in what you said, Dr. Kalani, but Dr. Caldas, want to ask you, with guidelines like those from the CDC or Veterans Affairs, how do you kind of integrate those into what's going on in the South Coast health system?
I think we, as I said, we've followed those guidelines, and I think it really just raises the awareness about the potential effects of using any class of medication. And so those types of guidelines really just make us more aware, help us to educate patients better about the medications they're using, whether or not it's an opiate or a benzodiazepine or any medications that potentially can have an addictive potential. Mm-hmm. So I think it's really just raised awareness. Mm-hmm. And fortunately, with the state efforts in public service announcements, not only amongst the medical community, but amongst the patients themselves, we have many patients who come in who are asking about what medicines they're being prescribed, mm-hmm. who are very keyed into knowing if they're on an opiate or not. So I think that all of those efforts have actually helped us to really reduce our use of opiates. Dr. Kalani had mentioned a group of patients, and I did want to mention them. The patients who are at pain clinics who may have pathology and have chronic pain who are appropriately using opiates and use them the way they're prescribed, don't show any of the addictive behaviors. There are millions of patients out there who are using them appropriately, and any of the comments I make aren't meant to actually disparage that appropriate use of opiate medication.
Right, and that was a question I had actually, was that there is a group of people with these pain issues, and, you know, there are critics who say that, you know, more policies and regulations are tying the hands of doctors who have to deal on an individual basis with patients who present with a wide variety of issues and symptoms. Dr. Kalani, what would you say to critics?
You know, I agree that there are many people who are on daily chronic opioids who are taking them as prescribed and may appear to be doing well. But that actually doesn't mean that the opioids are helping them. I believe that these are patients who are doing well despite being on opioids, not because of being on opioids. The fact that patients can do well on opioids is really the basis behind treating opioid addiction with methadone maintenance or with buprenorphine. Mm-hmm. It is possible for people to function and do okay. But that doesn't mean you're getting effective pain relief. If you're taking the same dose of an opioid every day for weeks and months and years, I think that the relief you experience when you're taking that opioid is the relief of withdrawal pain, not the relief of an underlying pain problem. I think that for some people with chronic pain, there is a role for opioids, mm-hmm. But that involves intermittent use of an opioid. It means using the opioid on the really bad day. If you're not taking it every day, then you don't become tolerant. You don't start to need higher and higher doses. And if you're not taking it every day, you also don't become dependent, meaning you're going to get sick or have a worsening of pain mm-hmm. when you try and get off. Hmm. So I think intermittent use can be effective. I think round-the-clock use for weeks and months and years is far more likely to harm people than help them.
Hmm. We have a call from Linda. She's on the phone from Falmouth. Linda, thanks so much for calling The Point.
Okay. My questions actually cover this current guest and the previous guest's comments. And I just have a couple of comments about this whole subject. One of them is, there are just, I've had a major surgery in the past year. My daughter's had two C-sections, and every time, with both C-sections, she was sent home with oxycodone, and she never needed it and never took it. And this is just the automatic, instead of how is your pain, what do you feel like, you know, it's just automatic. And with my surgery, it was the same thing. I came home with a prescription for, you know, X number of pills. Well, why don't they start with a prescription for 5? Instead of a prescription for 20. This happens routinely, and I just don't get it. I mean, I was fine with Tylenol, and I just don't understand why this is sort of like, we'll assume that this is the way to go because you're going to start off with a prescription of 20 and It amazes me. Well,
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
And I also was concerned or curious, I guess, about the IV Tylenol. I mean, there has been a lot of concern about Tylenol and, you know, heavy uses of Tylenol. I don't know how it's, you know, done with IV Tylenol, but that's, you know, liver concerns and other things. So I'm just wondering if we're going to, you know, sort of go from one thing to all of a sudden creating a problem with something else without it being, you know, vetted.
Sure. Linda, thank you. Two important kind of topics that you covered there. And it sounds like you are, you know, empowered to ask questions and to not just, you know, take those prescriptions, but you're thinking hard about what you want to, how you want to treat your pain. But then about the question with the IV Tylenol, Dr. Caldas, can you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. The doses used would not put anybody in jeopardy. They actually are routine doses that are used for pain control. And IV Tylenol is very effective. It is Tylenol, so that the increase in getting to a steady state or pain relief occurs a lot quicker than taking it orally.
Right, it's right into your bloodstream.
But it is Tylenol, and it's used in appropriate doses. It's used intermittently, especially in the emergency room or on the ambulance, so it would never put anybody in a condition that would affect their liver.
Mm. And I want to talk now a little bit about in Massachusetts and in other states, we now have prescription drug monitoring programs. This kind of speaks to this, you know, we've got the Baker administration trying to make some policy changes by, you know, the 7-day prescription limit. But we're still seeing, it sounds like, we're still seeing maybe some larger prescriptions being written in certain cases. Talk a little bit, Dr. Caldas, talk a little bit about the prescription drug monitoring program here in Massachusetts and what it's intended to do.
The prescription monitoring program is intended to, check the number of opiates that are being prescribed. So it can actually identify prescribers who are heavy prescribers of opiates. But it can also help to coordinate a patient's care. Frequently, a practitioner will see a patient, may opt to use a medication like an opiate short term. But we really need to understand whether or not that patient may have other active prescriptions from other providers in the system. So this allows us to look in through pharmacy data, see whether or not any other opiate prescriptions have been prescribed recently. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, we also have access in our hospital system to the similar program in Rhode Island. So we're able to actually look at a wide area to see whether or not patients may have more than one active prescription.
Mm-hmm. Are they mandatory? It's mandatory for doctors now to use
this. Writing a prescription to check the prescription monitoring program.
And Dr. Kalani, other states, it looks like, have these similar programs and have started to add some other data, patient data, like arrest history and things like that. Is that a good thing? Is that helping?
I have not heard of adding arrest history to PDMTs. I find that a little hard to believe.
Okay, maybe that's in the proposal stages.
Yeah, I don't think that's a good idea. I think putting onto the PDMP, though, data about non-fatal overdoses is very important. Something we've seen are people who are addicted to opioids are being prescribed lots of opioids. They wind up getting treated for an overdose. They're discharged from the hospital, and they go back to the doctor and get another prescription. And that shouldn't happen. There should be ways of getting information to the prescribers that the patient had suffered a non-fatal overdose. Making prescribers use the PDMPs, making use mandatory, is something that many state medical societies have been resistant to. Because if you're making it mandatory, it can mean that there's a penalty or a punishment for a doctor that doesn't check. And making it mandatory is also opposed because many state medical societies feel that prescribers should be able to use their judgment in deciding when to look at that database to view the patient's prescription history and when not to. Unfortunately, use does need to be made mandatory because in states that have not required doctors to use the PDMP, utilization is very low. And unfortunately, many doctors think they can tell by looking at somebody who may or may not have a problem. And of course, you can't tell. Opioid addiction can happen to anyone. And so we really do need to make it mandatory. In the states that have made it mandatory, utilization goes way up. Not only do we see a sharp decrease in prescriptions written to people who are visiting multiple doctors, the term for that sometimes is doctor shoppers, but you also see a decline in the very casual prescribing because it's a little more effort now to check. And so in many cases where an opioid has been necessary at all, you'll see a drop in those types of prescriptions because the prescriber doesn't want to have to look at the database.
Right, that extra step. And I guess you can make the argument that there are a lot of pressures on a doctor, you know, to keep their visits to a certain time, and there's this paperwork. And I guess you can imagine there'd be a little pushback from busy doctors in certain places. I'm curious, how much are we educating physicians? I'll ask this of you, Dr. Caldas, in your system, South Coast Health. What kinds of education are you giving physicians? Because certainly we've talked already about there's the guidelines, and you are implementing some new, recently new things like the Tylenol, the IV Tylenol. So how else are you educating?
We educate our physicians in a variety of ways. One is through our department meetings. Opiates and the order set changes that we're making are discussed at department meetings, at our medical executive committee meetings, and also biannually we hold a risk management conference in Massachusetts. You need a certain amount of continuing medical education credits now with opiate prescribing. And so we twice a year hold a Saturday morning conference where providers can come in, get their credits, and the whole morning can be dedicated to the use of opiates. We just recently had our last one several weeks ago and spent several hours educating doctors about the products themselves, the medications, the use of some of the medication-assisted treatment therapies, and opiates in general.
And Dr. Kalani, are you seeing kind of more concentrated efforts to educate doctors across other health systems, maybe in Massachusetts or even in other states?
Yes, there's certainly been a push to get doctors better educated on opioid prescribing. Many states like Massachusetts have mandated continuing medical education on opioid prescribing. And the reason that legislators are making this mandatory is because of finally this recognition that the way doctors have been prescribing has gotten us into this mess. So let's make doctors get education so they'll prescribe more cautiously. That's the idea. Unfortunately, in reality, much of the education that's being made available to prescribers is, I'm afraid, not really going to promote more cautious prescribing. Many of the courses are taught by doctors who have financial ties to opioid manufacturers. The content in many of these courses that are being used to meet the mandate, instead of really promoting more cautious prescribing, or, for example, telling doctors don't start more back pain patients on long-term opioids, instead of saying don't do it, they're teaching sort of a pseudoscience around here's how to do it. And the doctors are given sort of told to use screening instruments and monitor their patients more closely, as if there's a way to do this that can turn it all into a rosy picture at the end of the day. And unfortunately, there really isn't. So making education mandatory, if the content isn't good, or if the content suggests that opioids are safe and effective for conditions where they're not safe or effective, that really doesn't help things and could make things even worse.
Dr. Caldas, you're kind of shaking your head. You have a thoughtful look on your face.
Well, I'm just thinking the conference that we had and that we hold really have no ties to pharma. And so everybody there is either an addiction specialist, pharmacist, attorney, legal perspectives, and the whole perspective from our system is about decreasing and really trying to avoid the use of opiates. We have one for our physicians group, an addiction specialist who is working with our primary care providers and providing educational sessions about opiates.
Okay. So it sounds like there really is no standard.
If I could just clarify, you know, I'm not suggesting that all of the education out there is awful.
Right.
I certainly do a fair amount of teaching myself, and I don't doubt that the education that you're doing is good. But much of the education around the country that's being mandated, the courses are awful. I could tell you that in many states, to meet the CME requirements, the courses that are being taught are taught by doctors who do have financial ties. Mm. So I'm glad to hear that that's not the case everywhere, and I certainly know that it isn't, but it is still a big problem.
Yeah, and it sounds like we've got a long way to go as well. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back just after these quick messages. You're listening to The Point. I'm Catherine Ident in for Mindy Togg, and we are talking about the opiate crisis and specifically the prescribing methods and practices and some of the changes with prescribing opioids. We are also taking your comments and questions. You can give us a call, 866-999-4626, or you can email us at thepoint@capeendislands.org. And with me here in studio is Dr. Robert Caldas, Senior Vice President and Chief Medical Officer at South Coast Health. And with us on the phone is Dr. Andrew Kaldlani. He's co-director of opioid policy research at Brandeis University. So let's talk a little bit more about alternatives. So, you know, you get a patient who comes in and with, you know, presenting certain pain, what do we have out there? We've talked about the IV ibuprofen. What else do we have?
We have medicines that we've used classically for pain that didn't have the same potency as the opiates, but we are now able to use them in combination, and they have additive effects. So we're trialing presently at South Coast and Ortocept for our surgical patients in orthopedics, where we can actually use these medicines in combination preoperatively and then follow up with them postoperatively. And we've been able to demonstrate a decrease in the need for opiate medication postoperatively in the first 48 hours. It's also unexpectedly led to a decrease in the number of pills that are prescribed at the time of discharge. So I think the use of alternate therapies like that are helpful. Additionally, we've also trialed a long-acting Novocaine product that can be used at the time of surgery and injected in and around the incision, that can provide non-opiate pain relief for up to 5 days.
Wow.
Likewise, in postoperative patients, we've seen marked decreases in the need for opiate medications in the first 48 hours postoperatively.
Mm.
So I think thinking about those novel approaches like that is one of the ways that we're actually going to decrease the use of opiates, but also, and we've kind of mentioned this group, protect the opiate-naive patients.
Right.
Because we not only don't want to use opiates in general, but we don't want to expose people who may become addicted to opiates without a need.
Mm-hmm. We've talked a lot about the pharmaceutical companies, which obviously have a humongous role in this entire discussion. We talked about Purdue saying, okay, we're not going to market OxyContin anymore. It was a huge money maker for that company. Other pharmaceutical companies make a lot of money on different types of opiates. Are they any research going on to find even other alternatives, through better living through chemistry? Dr. Kaldlani, do you know?
Yes, there's a tremendous incentive for pharmaceutical companies to develop products for chronic pain because chronic pain is extraordinarily common. One of the problems we've seen with the marketing of opioids, and why I think it's nice that Purdue will stop from marketing, is that all of the opioids have really been promoted for conditions like low back pain, fibromyalgia, chronic headache, the really common conditions where we shouldn't be using opioids. Opioids are essential medicines for easing suffering at the end of life. They play a really important role when used for a couple of days after major surgery. But for those conditions, there's not much money to be made by pharmaceutical companies. End of life care, patients won't be on your product for very long, and it's not that common a condition.
Mm-hmm.
And for acute pain as well, they're only going to take your medicine for a few days. So all of the manufacturers have promoted for chronic pain. There is a tremendous incentive for pharmaceutical companies to continue looking for products for chronic pain. There's federal money now to incentivize research for chronic pain treatments, although we probably don't need that federal money because I don't know that we need public-private partnerships for very common conditions. All of that said, though, we do have treatments for chronic pain that are safe and effective. They are just underprescribed. Mm-hmm. Physical therapy can be very helpful for many people who suffer from chronic pain. For many types of chronic pain, it's related to lifestyle or being overweight. Changing one's lifestyle, exercising more, eating better, there are many different strategies that are non-pharmacologic that can also help people with chronic pain. One of the things we saw as prescribing took off from the 90s through up until around 2011, every year we were setting new records for opioid prescribing. As the prescribing of opioids went up, alternatives, both pharmacologic alternatives, medicines like Advil and Tylenol, and non-pharmacologic alternatives, the prescribing of those alternatives started to go down.
I don't know
that we really need to look for a new magic bullet. Okay. I think we need to start appropriately prescribing and recommending therapies that are safer and more effective. Mm.
And we have a call from Barbara in Hyannis. Barbara, thanks for calling in.
Hi. I'm just listening to your program. I'm rather disturbed about it in the sense that I've been a nurse for over 45 years, working in all parts of surgery and intensive care, most of it. And I'm appalled at this constant barrage against human beings that have chronic pain or surgeries that it's just the doctor's fault that they're taking too many pills. Hmm. Personally, I've seen a huge reduction in the number of pills that are ordered, and it's ordered based on the physician's evaluation of the surgery and the patient. To assume that certainly the local physicians on the Cape involved certainly in surgery are just wantonly prescribing is ridiculous. I myself take a barely just made on the list Tramadol, and I have to go to my doctor's office every 3 to 6 months to be examined. Mm-hmm. I also go to the pain center. They do a great job. But it's very difficult to get your insurance to pay for that.
Yeah.
They burn the nerves, so I get 6 months of pain-free, basically, as long as I do nothing. But I'm still young and vibrant, and to say that, it's my job as a nurse to hand a prescription to the patient. They frequently say, oh, I can't take this. I say, well, what do you want to take?
Yeah.
And they'll name some other pill. I said, have you had that? Well, no, that's just what everybody says you shouldn't take. I said, look, they only gave you 10 of them. If you don't want them, don't take them.
Right. And thank you.
You can get less.
Thank you, Barbara.
You can go to the pharmacy.
Well, and it's important to note, too, that we're looking at a specific element of this crisis, which really has a lot of different kind of threads that we could explore.
It keeps basting at the hospitals and it keeps blasting at the physicians. And quite honestly, my understanding is in very few medical schools is the concept of becoming an opioid specialist ever offered.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for your comments, Barbara. Certainly adding to this conversation that we're having we're certainly all the way down to the individual level, how a doctor interacts with a patient and what a patient's expectations are, all the way up to a systemic level. And then, of course, nationwide and looking at statistics, even as we were talking about at the top of the show from the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. And Barbara kind of alluded to this a little bit, the doctor might prescribe a set amount of pills, believing very much so that this patient needs them, and the patient can say yes or no to those. How much kind of management of expectations needs to happen between a doctor and a patient? I mean, you've got, of course, relationships that doctors can have with a patient for decades, but then if you've got someone coming into the ER that you've never seen before, there's a lot of trust that goes on there, but there certainly sounds like there needs to be some discussion. Is it happening, Dr. Caldas?
It's starting to happen more and more. And I think we do have to reset expectations. I think the general public has an impression that you can go through a major surgery with no discomfort or have a condition that has pain associated with it, and that we should be able to get rid of the pain. We need to realize that pain can be helpful mm-hmm. and can be a sign that things are either not going as well or worsening. Can also be a sign with the lessening that things are getting better. Mm. So pain serves a function to let us know that things are not okay. So we don't necessarily want zero for all conditions. We want to keep people comfortable.
Right.
And I think that's been an expectation, or that is an expectation that we're going to have to reset with people and explain it, that we will keep you comfortable. But yes, there will be some discomfort associated with this.
Mm.
Patients do have an option, and I think Barbara had alluded to it a little bit, that they can, with a prescription, even if the doctor prescribes 30 pills, go to the pharmacy and in Massachusetts request a lesser quantity. And so, you know, that's available to patients now. Additionally, DPH has a form which is called a voluntary non-opioid directive that patients can download and fill out and present to their healthcare provider that says, I do not want opiates used in my treatment. And that, once presented to the provider, is actually put into the electronic health record and in our system, is used throughout the system to alert people that this patient has opted not to use opiates in their treatment.
Mm. It really does sound to me that as we kind of still kind of societally here, culturally, get a grip on this crisis and try to stem it at the same time, that, you know, education needs to be happening both for physicians and healthcare providers to understand the impacts, but then the best ways, as you mentioned, Dr. Caldas, to use opioids, right? They exist for a reason. There's a certain subset of people. But then on the patient side, you know, to empower patients to say, well, what else can we do? Or, you know, tell me why you think that this prescription is the best course of action for my condition, rather than just, I guess, you know, take it blindly, in a
right.
sense.
And yeah. there's increasing more education going on about opiates in general. Patients are now being informed about the addictive potential and the downsides of using it, as well as the benefits.
Dr. Kolodny, we've been talking about pharmaceutical companies all hour, and what other responsibility do they have? They can be, you know, as you said, developing new alternatives, and they're stopping some marketing of some of the drugs that are out there. But what other responsibility do those companies have, given just the scope of this and how many people in this country are addicted?
Yeah, well, so the opioid manufacturers, pharmaceutical companies that make opioids, didn't simply play an important role in causing this epidemic by getting prescribing to go up. They've also been blocking efforts to promote more cautious prescribing. A report by the Associated Press and the Center for Public Integrity published last year found that over the past decade, they had spent $880 million blocking state and federal efforts to promote more cautious prescribing, often by giving money to front groups. And we've seen that play out even in Massachusetts. According to the report, the opioid lobby, the manufacturers and distributors trying to preserve the status quo of aggressive prescribing, had outspent the gun lobby 8 times in their efforts to block cautious prescribing. So one thing that would be very nice to see would be for them to stop interfering with efforts to promote more cautious prescribing, stop giving money to front groups like the U.S. Pain Foundation, which has been very active in Massachusetts. And there was just an investigation done by the Senate Homeland Security, a minority staff, showing that millions are being funneled to these groups that are trying to block cautious prescribing. Just, I'd like to follow up finally on one point made by the caller.
Well, actually, Dr. Kolodny, we are out of time, and thank you so much for talking with us today. So clearly, a topic that is has much left to be explored. Some small gains, but a lot of work to do. Dr. Kolodny, co-director of the Opioid Policy Research Center at the Heller School for Social Policy and Management at Brandeis University, joining us on the phone. Thank you so much for spending time with us this morning, as well as Dr. Robert Caldas, Senior Vice President and Chief Medical Officer of South Coast Health. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening, joining us on today's point. I'm Catherine Ident, in for Mindy Todd.